Welcome to the Med Device Cyber Podcast, the podcast that dives into the critical world of medical device cybersecurity. I'm your host, Christian Espinoza, joined by my colleague, Trevor Slattery. Each week, we explore the latest trends, share expert insights, and discuss real-life stories that highlight the importance of protecting the devices we trust with our health. Whether you're a manufacturer, regulatory affairs professional, or a concerned loved one, this podcast is for you. Let's get started.
Hey there, welcome back. Today we're going to be talking about security considerations as part of the design phase of a device and what can be done to prevent vulnerabilities from popping up further right in the development process, and looking at some of the big considerations as far as the areas that should be covered by security in the eyes of the regulatory bodies such as the FDA.
All right. Sounds pretty serious stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when we're looking at these medical devices and the impact of breaching them, it can get pretty serious.
All right. And where do these controls come from you're talking about we're going to cover? Are these standard best practices, or like where do they come from?
These controls are partially going to be standard best practices industry-wide. And they're also going to come, we're going to look at the FDA's requirements, since that's what we have the most experience dealing with and what we see the most, and what the FDA sees as the most important areas to address cybersecurity.
Okay. Awesome. So I think one of those requirements is authentication. Is that correct?
Yeah. And how we're getting to the controls around these requirements. So I want to talk a little bit about a requirement in a device, period. So there can be
a good place to start. We should back up a little bit and talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead. Sorry.
There can be the functional requirement in a device. So if I have my cell phone right here, a functional requirement is put a password in place to log into the phone. Now, the non-functional requirement there might be, how is that password protected? Is it just stored in plain text somewhere in the phone where if someone gets in, they can just read it? Is it hashed in some way? Is it stored up in the cloud? Is there an authentication manager? The non-functional requirements are sort of where it can get a little bit murky and where security really needs to be looked at. So for each of these items, they are typically going to be the non-functional requirements that we're looking at more. And for each of the functional requirements, we need to
understand. This is kind of like cybersecurity as a whole. Isn't cybersecurity as a whole like a non-functional requirement typically?
Pretty much. A lot of people see cybersecurity as a necessary evil. It's that one thing you have to do once a year to make sure that you're able to keep selling your product, which is often a hard way to think about it, since that means you're often not addressing security at the very beginning and often making it a little bit harder on yourself later down the line. So that's
what does that mean, necessary evil? I was just thinking, I've heard that term a lot with cybersecurity. I'm thinking like what else is a necessary evil? As necessary evil in life? Is it just cybersecurity, or is there something else?
I mean, great example, like going to the dentist every year. I want to make sure that my teeth look pretty nice, but I don't necessarily like driving all the way down to Phoenix every time I have to go to the dentist. And so that's not always something I'm excited for, to wake up and do that. I'm not excited for a $3,000 bill at the end of the day for going to the dentist either. But
I guess that is a necessary evil. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went to the dentist once and they messed up the drilling my teeth and I haven't been back. I almost passed out. It hurt so badly. I was trying to like just deal with it because they're drilling out to put a cap on it or whatever, and a crown, I think it's called. And they forgot to put the right Novocaine or whatever, those injections. I was just trying to handle it, but tears started coming down my eyes. The pain was so bad. So I haven't been back to the dentist since then. So it definitely was evil for sure. Yeah.
Well, you definitely should go to the dentist. So that's a whole other conversation.
I brush my teeth and floss them, you know. Why do I need to go to the dentist?
I brush my teeth and floss them every day still. I have great teeth, but last time I went, I had to get some work done. So.
Okay. All right.
You should go to the dentist.
All right. But, so that's another necessary evil. It's like cybersecurity.
All right. So it's.
So cybersecurity is a necessary evil, you're saying, and these controls are necessary as part of cybersecurity. But it's also the non-functional requirements is what you're saying is where cybersecurity typically falls into. So one of the things we talked about was authentication, right? That's one of the controls that are necessary.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's part of the example with using my phone for authentication.
Yeah.
If I want to authenticate, that's proving that I am able to access the system. So
that's proving you say you are who you say you are, right? And that's typically done through like a username, a password, a PIN. You know, there's multiple factors of authentication, right?
Correct. Or it can be, you know, a token, a physical device, a little hardware token, okay, anything. And authentication can be handled in a few different layers. So there's usually the initial authentication. There can be multi-factor authentication where, like, if I'm signing into my email account, I get a little text up on my phone with a code. And that helps to make sure that security is addressed. And that's
so that's using at least two factors of authentication. And right? So what are the factors? So everyone knows what multi-factor authentication is, in case people don't.
So the first factor would be my username and password. That's factor one. And the second factor...
That's something you know. Something you know.
Yeah.
Username, password. Okay.
There can be something you know, something you have, and something you are.
Something you have is like your phone to receive a text message? Or
that would be my phone for like a one-time password.
Okay. Or you have to have the phone. Yep.
Something you are, kind of an example of that would be like a CAPTCHA, making sure that you are not advised trying to scrape something, saying you are an authorized user, you're not just a web scraper. So it gives you a CAPTCHA to prove that you are who you say you are.
Yeah, I always thought something you are is biometric. The CAPTCHA example may work as well, but biometric, like your eyes, you know, iris scan, a retina scan, which is not used that often, a hand geometry scan, a thumbprint, a fingerprint. That's something that is unique to you, something you are.
I often see thumbprint as being the pretty popular option there, but I typically don't see a thumbprint for a medical device. And so the something you are becomes a little bit of a looser interpretation. Oftentimes what we recommend is usually multi-factor authentication is going to be two of the three. And we recommend something you know and something you have for that. And so the something you have is either going to be like a hardware token or a one-time code from your phone. And then the something you know. In a lot of sensitive environments, we'll address the something you are as far as like a biometric consideration. But like you said, they're not as common. And they're much less common in a medical device.
Yeah. Well, often these devices are in a semi-secure area physically. You know, they're in a protected area of the hospital, but they're also in a hostile environment if they're connected to the hospital network. I consider hospital networks hostile because from my experience with pen testing and everything else in hospitals, it's kind of like the Wild West. Nothing's segmented. Everything's on the same network. And you can go in the chapel in the hospital and plug into an Ethernet port. And next thing you know, you're scanning medical devices that are in the OR, the operating room. So it's pretty pretty scary. And authentication is extremely important in that case. And we've found many of these devices, and I think you talked about this in a previous episode, that have the default username and password for like a web admin interface to the medical device.
Yeah, that's a pretty common thing to find. A lot of devices will integrate a third-party component or like a database, for an example, and it's just admin for the credentials. Boom, there you go. And you're able to compromise sensitive information without necessarily needing to perform some complicated hack against a device, you know, kind of the movie style stuff. It's just go in, guess the password, get out. And so that's definitely a pretty big problem that we see as far as authentication goes. Another one of these concerns is going to be authorization. And authorization is essentially proving that you are able to access, proving that you're approved to access this data.
Yeah. So once you're authenticated, that just means you are who you say you are, but then you have to be authorized to what you can do on the system, right?
Correct. And authorization is going to be handled in two ways. Usually we'll see different users. And so that could be when you go to log into your email, you're looking at your emails alone. If you log into your email, you can't see my emails or different roles where if an administrator logs in, they might be able to see everyone's emails, but the user level should only see their own emails. And a very big part of pen testing, and likely one of our biggest findings and most common findings on medical devices, is broken authorization. We're able to compromise one user account and use that one user account to compromise 100 more. And that's a very big deal for the FDA. That's part of the multi-patient harm view and the sort of widespread impact of compromising a device.
What does that mean? We could do another episode on these security architecture views, but multi-patient harm view, that means if we hack into a device, we can cause damage not just to one patient, but to multiple patients at the same time, right?
Yep, exactly. And that can be through a few different ways. That can be compromising one device and using an exploit on the device to attack another user on that same device. Or it can be compromising a device and then moving through a network to compromise a different device. I know earlier you were saying some of your stories about pen testing hospital networks and how it's kind of the Wild West. I know one of my personal favorites is hacking into a printer if I'm doing a pen test in a hospital network. And I can breach this printer. I can move from the printer into a workstation. I can move from the workstation into an x-ray machine or into a data store and find patient records, something of that nature. And I actually remember not too long ago, I had that exact scenario come up where there were default credentials on a printer. The printer had domain credentials, and the domain credentials worked on file shares with patient records. And so by getting into that printer, I was able to just spread out through the network. So that's sort of the multi-patient harm view, is moving from one device to another or one user to another.
And affecting multiple patients, you know, like it says, yeah, exactly. harming multiple patients with one attack effectively.
Yep.
Now, okay, so we covered authentication, authorization. The next control for medical devices is cryptography. And cryptography, I know you've got some experience with that. Like one of the devices I worked on a long time ago, one of the things that was neglected from a cryptography perspective, which equates to encryption, is the hard drive of this device was not encrypted. This is an IVD device, in vitro diagnostics device. It had sensitive data on the device. And they didn't have clear disposal instructions. So when people, like hospitals, were done using this device, it was like end of life, they would just like sell it to somebody that bought old, used hospital equipment, and they would end up on eBay occasionally. And people were buying the device, taking the hard drive out of it, and they could, you know, put the hard drive in another device and read all the data on that hard drive, which obviously was a problem. And this was resolved by them encrypting with full disk encryption that hard drive. But they didn't have the cryptographic means at the time, so that was a disclosure. It wasn't an effect to patient harm, but a disclosure of confidentiality.
Yeah, that's a pretty good example. I know that full disk encryption is something that we see come up as a problem all the time. Encryption concerns need to be addressed at two levels. There's the encryption at rest, and so that's going to be like that hard drive example. And then the encryption in transit. So that's anything going over the air, anything going over a physical wire. If I'm able to sit on that wire kind of as a man in the middle listening to a connection, I shouldn't be able to know what's actually going on. It should be encrypted. It should just be gibberish to me. The same way as if I'm getting into a hard drive and I'm trying to snoop around, see what I can read, I shouldn't be able to actually read anything unless I prove that I'm able to access that data.
Yeah, and that's a good point with the data at rest and data in transit. And then I know like the Poodle attack, that was a problem with using a weak cipher suite, right? The Poodle attack, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's not something that you see too often anymore, but once in a while we'll actually find some of the older exploits. Actually, not too long ago, I think maybe about a month or so ago, we were able to find a similar padding attack to the Poodle attack on a device.
Okay, awesome. So we talked about authentication, authorization, cryptography, and another control is code, data, and execution integrity. Can you explain a little bit about that one? I have a story about that one too, but I'll start with you.
Yeah, that one comes into three parts: the code, data, and execution. So we're looking at making sure that nothing's been tampered with. The code itself can be opened up to a lot of different supply chain attacks. If there's a malicious insider who's pushing out bad changes to GitHub, or if someone's able to go in, modify the code, and start pushing out updates to a device so that it is running a bad version of software, that would be a compromise of the code integrity. In the same way, we have to make sure that any data stored on the device is authentic. So there should be controls in place around data to make sure that no one can get in and tamper it without clear evidence, clear logging trails. They should be authenticated and authorized to access that data to begin with, and there shouldn't be any way to bypass that to modify the data. Execution integrity is going to be pretty similar to code integrity with a key distinction. That's essentially looking at runtime, making sure that everything is what it should be. This can be done with a couple of ways. A pretty popular one is like a checksum, so just a little numerical identifier that is essentially the hashed version of the binary running or the runtime environment, making sure that is compared with a copy that is known good, making sure that those line up. And if there's a mismatch, something went wrong, abort the process and start over. So we want to make sure that nothing has been tampered with as part of the process. It's one of the big considerations with ensuring that data is intact and authentic.
And one way to fix this is with secure boot. I know we had a client not too long ago that had their product on a microprocessor that did not support secure boot. So the ultimate solution was to change the microprocessor to support secure boot, which provided that code and data and execution integrity.
Yeah, that can be a pretty good solution. Secure boot essentially is just making sure that the device is booting up in a known good state. Another thing that we really like to see, and is one of my key recommendations, is audit trails. So if someone is going in and modifying data, that should be recorded. Who did that and what did they audit? What was it before? What is going on? All of that should be documented, and that audit log should also be very well protected. It can be a pretty good attack path for a lot of criminals to go in, change data, and then go into the audit log and change the logging information so that it's not actually recorded what they did and there's no evidence of it. So making sure the data is protected and making sure that the evidence that it is protected is also well protected is pretty important.
Yeah, that's a good point, that the data integrity of the audit logs is extremely important. And event detection and logging is also one of the categories for the cybersecurity controls, which ties into what you're saying. But these all go together, basically, right? If we have events logged, but they're not protected with data integrity, then this is pretty common, that an attacker can just overwrite them or write malicious or bogus logs to the system, and you can't actually figure out what happened if there's an incident.
Yeah, that's definitely something that is a good point. All of these are pretty connected. You can't really say, oh, well, we're covering cryptography, so everything else is fine. These need to work in tandem to create a secure device and sort of the secure enclosed system. With the logging and detection specifically, it is looking at what information is captured and where that's stored, how that's stored, for how long, and who can access it. The detection is a pretty important part. Any anomalous behavior should be captured. An easy example is, you know, I'm sure this happens to you all the time. It kind of happens to everyone. You'll get a little pop-up on your phone saying, oh, is this actually you trying to log into your computer? And sometimes it is. Once in a while, it's not. And then you have a problem to go figure out. I know not too long ago, I got a login from Brazil, which was a little bit weird. And so I had to go and cycle all my passwords, get everything all figured out there. But what sort of events are being captured? Are there weird login attempts that people are tracking? Are there, let's say, are you logging that data has been tampered? Are you logging that data has been moved, or a copy of the data has been exported, a new user is created? The list can go on pretty much forever. You can do a whole series of episodes about just what information you should capture depending on the specific device. But in general, behavior that is outside of the normal should be captured, and it should be very clear who can access that, what they can do with it, how long it's stored, anything around that nature.
Yes, good point. We could probably do an episode on each of these categories. There's 8 of them. We covered 5 of them so far. Confidentiality is another one. Go ahead.
Confidentiality is a little bit of an interesting one. This is one that I kind of think about in a little bit of a different way from some of the other ones. This one is hard to be a standalone topic. Usually it's covered by proper authentication and proper authorization, which is kind of an interesting way to say, well, if you have these two, you have these three. But as long as data is confidential, so it's only shown to those who should have access to it and are approved to it, that who has access to it and who is approved to it is immediately covered by authentication and authorization.
Yeah, because we covered cryptography, and I often think of confidentiality equals encryption. But in this case, you're saying authentication, authorization combined, because these things are interrelated with encryption, provide that confidentiality.
Yep, exactly. And interestingly enough, that's one of the FDA stances on it as well. As part of their guidance, when you're going through and looking at these controls, they explicitly call each of these out. And for confidentiality, they say that they want to look at your controls around authorization and authentication as the primary source of confidentiality.
Interesting. I think encryption plays a role in that too. Obviously, like we talked about the scenario where the equipment was disposed of, the IVD device, and the hard drive did not have full disk encryption. Right. So there's 2 more of these categories that the FDA recommends. The other one is resilience and recovery. So in this case, we're talking about how does a device fail? If it's under a cyber attack, how does it recover itself? How to restore the device? Is there anything else we need to be concerned about with resilience and recovery?
Yeah, I think the resilience part is sort of deflecting those attacks in the first place. There's no perfect security, unfortunately. As much as it would be nice to say, in a perfect world, you can fix everything. It's not the place. So seeing what the device can fend off, in a sense, if you have a firewall and that firewall is blocking all these port scanning attempts and vulnerability scanners and just getting barraged with tons of information all the time, that can act as a sort of resilience. And the recovery is, well, these protections are going to fail eventually. No protection is perfect, and with enough time, enough resources, and enough talent, a bad guy might be able to get in regardless. So if something bad happens, how are you getting to a known good state? How does the device recognize we're in crisis mode, we have to recover? If there's just a total crash, how is it going to get back and not continue to crash? How is it going to get back to a state that we know is good, is safe, and is clean?
Awesome. I think resilience is important in life and in general, not just in medical devices. It's an important skill. I try to do hard things so I can maintain my resilience.
Yep.
So the last one, we got one more category. This is a little controversial, I think, this one, is firmware and software updates. There's this drive to make sure we can remotely patch all these medical devices, and the manufacturer can remotely do it. They can remotely push updates to the device. But that opens up some concerns, doesn't it? That remote connection to the device?
Yeah, there are a couple of problems that can come up there. I know on kind of a previous episode, we had talked about a situation where I was testing an acne laser for security, and it was meant to be an enclosed system, no connectivity, and any updates would require a technician to go on site. But I was able to introduce connectivity through a vulnerability in a USB port. I was able to put in a network adapter and create network connectivity. Once I had that, the gates were open. There were so many attacks that get exposed to this device by network connectivity. And that's often the case with other devices. Network connectivity opens it up to the general internet. It can be discovered if you are on that same network. It can be found. Oftentimes, all it takes is walking into a hospital, finding an unprotected Ethernet port, and plugging it in. And then you're able to find that device. So while it can add a lot of convenience as far as the update procedure, It streamlines the process for the manufacturer if they need to make a change to the device. It also increases the sort of the threat landscape and the just the potential risk to the device. There's a lot more that you can do to a network connected device. So it's definitely a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and we had a client that was doing remote updates of the device, but you have to consider what's on the distant end of the remote updates. At least, you know, we consider that. On the distant end, it was their entire corporate network. So their entire corporate network, anyone on that network could connect to the medical device and remotely update it. So our solution was to segment only the people that needed to do the updates. Only that network could remotely connect to the devices, because I think you use the term threat landscape or the attack surface. If the entire corporate network can connect to a medical device, if somebody in the corporate network, like the HR person, clicks on email and their computer becomes infected, now that HR computer can push a malicious update potentially to all the medical devices. So that's why we're saying there's some pros and cons to this. You have to do it in the secure and smart way.
Yeah, and that's a good point about the update infrastructure itself is you have to make sure that that part is secure as well. That's sort of the global view of the device. That's the end-to-end, everything connected to it, everything involved with it needs to be addressed as far as security. And if the update server can be compromised, like you said, you can push out malicious packages to the device. You can do a lot of pretty nasty stuff there.
Yeah. I know we covered like the 8 cybersecurity controls recommended by the FDA. In your opinion, Trevor, do you think like if a medical device manufacturer follows these 8 things, that the device will be secure, or are there other things that they should consider?
It's difficult with a medical device because of how loose the term medical device is. A medical device can be anything from a bandage to a surgery robot. There is such a wide range. So, of course, we're only looking at cyber devices here, which are devices with a computer, some sort of software component. The considerations here are a very good general first area to look at. In most cases, these are going to cover the vast majority of security considerations, but each device is unique. Each, you know, landscape is unique. The attack surface is going to be unique. And as a result, the security considerations need to be unique, which is why it's really important to start addressing security sort of far left in the development cycle at the initial inception phase.
So you're advocating for an SSDLC, as they like to say, a secure software development lifecycle, where we actually develop the requirements, the design with security or cybersecurity in mind. It sounds like you're an advocate of that, or DevSecOps, some people like to say as well.
Exactly. It's something that should be thought of in the early phases instead of letting it slip to the end. And it saves time, it saves money. The cost of remediation and sort of redesigning a device when you're about ready to submit is a lot more significant than if you had just addressed security in the first place. It also takes a lot more time to go back. You might find that a security flaw is in a functionality that can't really be changed. And so you might have to change the core functionality of the device as a result. So making sure that you're hitting security early and often typically saves a lot of headache down the line.
100%. I'm an advocate for what is that saying? Measure twice and cut once, you know?
So, yeah, measure twice, cut once.
Yeah. We want to do it right the first time from the beginning before we actually start, making the production or producing something or making our cuts or manufacturing something. Or even doing the software development. It's all ties together. Awesome. Well, I think we covered the 8 categories here pretty well that the FDA recommends. And I hope if you're listening, you got some value out of this and some insights out of this episode. And we'll hope to see you on the next one. Have a great one.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Med Device Cyber Podcast. We hope you gained valuable insights into the world of medical device cybersecurity. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Should cybersecurity be top of mind for your medical device company and you wish to learn more about how Blue Goat Cyber can help your business, please click on the link in the show notes below to book a discovery call with our team. Stay informed and empowered to protect yourself and the people your company serves. Until next time, stay safe and secure.